This is Like Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Milwaukee's Forest Home Cemetery is filled with many grand sculptures that mark gravesites. But there's one bronze sculpture of an angel that is going to be celebrating a homecoming of sorts. The Fitch family were early bankers in Milwaukee and had a bronze statue called the Angel of Peace standing at their family plot. When a wave of vandalism hit the cemetery about 6 years ago, the statue was damaged and put into storage, until recent conservation efforts not only repaired the statue, but uncovered its significant history. To share the statue's journey, I'm joined by Forest Home volunteer docent and sculpture curator Brian Fetty and the Forest Home Preservation Association's executive director, Sarah Tomlin. Fetty begins by sharing the legacy of the Fitch family, who commissioned the statue.
It is a work commissioned, we believe, between, say, 1902, 1907. We don't know the exact time. The Fitches were a prominent Milwaukee banking family, just about a block away from where we are in our studios today at Broadway and Michigan, in the Loyalty Building, today the Hilton Garden Inn, which was a bank called the National Exchange Bank. And across the street was the bank of Alexander Mitchell, who became the wealthiest man in the state. And at one point, the Fitch family and the Mitchell family merged their banks to form what became Marine Bank,
which is now Chase Tower, right where we're sitting in right now.
And the connection in this story is that a son of the founder of the bank, Elliot Grant Fitch, was really responsible for the construction of Marine Bank in this place in the early 1960s.
Right. And Forest Home, you know, has a lot of longtime Milwaukee families, including the Fitch family. And this bronze angel, it's called the Angel of Peace, that sits on top of their plot. It was first exhibited at the Great Berlin Art Exhibition of 1902, but do we have any idea of when it was commissioned for a gravesite? I assume some family members had passed already before this sculpture was here.
Yeah, I think I'd like to go back a little bit to include Martha Fitch, who was one of the all-time power women of Milwaukee. Her husband, of course, being a banker, didn't hurt when she went to found the Woman's Club of Wisconsin with a group of other prominent women as well. But they were able to get advice of how to go out and sell stock certificates to raise money. And Milwaukee became the first city in the United States where women paid for and erected their own building. And then Martha was also very involved in the education of women and founded an organization called the College Endowment Association, which still exists today and of which I am a member.
Was Martha the person of the Fitch family who commissioned this sculpture for the Forest Home family plot?
I believe she was involved and one of the most likely. We don't have records of family members traveling directly to Berlin. But what happened is William Grant Fitch and Martha bought a plot at Forest Home, believing it was going to be for them. And the tragedy, and you see this in the angel, is that the first person to be buried there was their son, Edward, who dies at the age of 22, right in the prime of life. And the following year, Martha's husband, Edward, dies. But another 10 years go by before a monument is erected. So a lot could have happened in there. Martha moves away to Santa Barbara, but we know that she traveled constantly back and forth to Europe. And her son, William Allen, was an Impressionist painter who studied in Paris at the same time as the sculptor of the angel. So some of the past is known, and it's just frustrating that you know just enough that you feel you should know the whole story.
Right. Well, and that's part of the fun yet frustration, right, of going through records and tying history together. And Sarah, we've worked together on a lot of stories with Forest Home and the extensive records that you have, but that doesn't necessarily include when people erect sculptures, right? You have a lot of death records and burial records,
yes,
is this a difficulty you're newly discovering?
Or? Yeah, our records are actually pretty impeccable for a cemetery of our age, being that we were established in 1850. However, as far as what goes on the plot that someone's purchased, we really don't have very many records at all of that. We were more in line with just what the business was of being a cemetery.
Right. And this angel in particular caught, well, didn't catch your attention in a great way. There was a wave of vandalism, and this statue was kind of cut from its base and turned, but still on it, so obviously damaged, needed to be removed and put into the basement. And both of you, Brian and Sarah, you both went to get a closer look. So what kind of was the point where you're like, okay, let's dig into this a little more after it had to be in storage for a while?
Well, I had been told the story of in 2018, there were a rash of metal thefts.
Because it was a bronze.
It was statue. Yeah. It was not just our cemetery, and also like the Basilica of St. Joseph Atz was struck. Our building had the copper flashing taken off of it. So it was all about the metal. And for whatever reason, the people who were trying to steal the bronze statue were interrupted. So it was cut from its base. It did have a little bit of damage. And we actually didn't have contact with family members from that plot to be able to talk to them about what we were going to do with it. So it got put in the basement. And then Brian Fetty, our sculpture curator, started asking questions about it.
So you're the reason, Brian. Well, and you go into this basement to get a closer look. What did you see? Like, what were your first hints?
Well, it was not easy to see. It was in a very dark place, and I'm crawling around on my hands and knees trying to find a mark that would tell us what it is. And I see it was actually cast in, that lists a foundry in Berlin. And we see a signature cut in. And just like you can't know all of history, you can read the signature except for the last letter.
Perfect.
And it's so frustrating. Is that a B? Is that an S? Who is this? So I contacted the foundry in Berlin, which, believe it or not, is still in existence. And I showed the curator a picture of this, and I said, you know, who is this? And the curator says, well, it's Martin Schaus. And every answer raises a new question. And the question was, great, who's Martin Schaus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so who was he? What's the significance and symbolism of the statue by Martin?
Well, it turns out he's one of the most decorated sculptors of Imperial Germany. And here's a work sitting out in the open in Milwaukee, and no one knows what it is. And a marble version of this angel. It is for a client in a cemetery in Berlin, and he dates the marble version 1899. He signs it Martin Schaus, Rome, and it exists to this day. So Martin Schaus comes back from Rome and exhibits at this one of the world's great art fairs, was the annual Great Art Exhibition of Berlin. In 1902, I actually found the catalog online and found that this work was there. We even know what room it was in.
Wow.
So we have total proof that it was exhibited. So I said, Sarah, can you believe this? This work that's been sitting out in the open for 120 years that we don't know what it is, it's by Germany's highest awarded artist. Shouldn't we be telling people about it? Is there any way to find the money to get it restored? Because it's in pretty bad shape. So Sarah took on the big mission of raising the money to get this restored.
Well, actually, it's the mission of the Forest Home Historic Preservation to do work like this. So we were set up to do it, and we fortunately were able to make contact with the granddaughter of Elliot Grant Fitch. She was not someone who we were in contact with when the theft happened, but she's someone who became what we call our lot representative, who gets to make decisions about the plots. And she is in contact with a lot of other relatives. She actually lives in Australia.
Wow. Okay.
And so we got donations from her and from a Fitch relative in France, several in California, Oregon. I mean, like, there are multiple Fitch relatives that chipped in to have this piece conserved.
Really a family effort, which I like after all of these years. And there will be an official rededication of this angel on the 21st, but for the both of you, having dug into history and, you know, traveled to Berlin, so to speak, and finding out about this sculpture and the family that still has ties to it, what does it mean to get a monument of Forest Home back to its former glory?
Well, I just think it's amazing. And I have to say that for so many years, the cemetery's just been thought of as just a cemetery. But because of our age and because of all the important people who have been buried there, if you see it from a different lens, there's so much more to the cemetery. And a lot of it is in our sculpture. Our sculpture is pretty spectacular. And we do want to raise more money to be able to take care of it all.
And for you, Brian?
So as the sculpture curator, we're now realizing that we are an outdoor museum. And we have works that people would fly over Milwaukee to see. And it's a place, I believe, to learn the most about the rich history of Milwaukee. But in doing so, are we going to disturb those who are there? The answer, we believe, is come and admire a beautiful place. And look at this angel who's saying, should I disturb this person? And we don't really want to disturb them, but we want to come learn about them and learn about our city of Milwaukee and who we are.
Brian Fetty is a volunteer docent and sculpture curator for Forest Home Cemetery, and Sarah Tomlin is the executive director of the Forest Home Preservation Association. The rededication of the Fitch family's Angel of Peace will take place this Saturday, and you can find out more information at WUWM.com. Later in the show, we'll visit the Green Tree Apartments in Milwaukee and learn how it has defied stereotypes of many public housing complexes. But first, we'll learn about a new podcast from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that explores possible mob ties to the death of a Milwaukee man in the 1970s. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In 1978, a Milwaukee man named Augie Palmisano was killed by a car bomb. His death remains unsolved, and a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter is looking for answers in a new podcast called My Cousin Augie. Investigative reporter Mary Spacuzza is Palmisano's cousin. She joins Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez to share what it was like looking into her cousin's murder and the possible connections to the Milwaukee Mafia.
Can you just tell us, who was your cousin Augie, and why are you telling a story now?
Sure. So my cousin Augie was August or Augie Palmisano. He was murdered when I was very young in downtown Milwaukee. He was killed when he tried to go to work and start his car in the morning, and there was a car bomb. Basically, when he tried to put the key in the ignition, there was a massive explosion. And he was killed instantly. Luckily, no one else was in the garage that morning, so he was the only person killed. It really shook the city. Milwaukee had a police chief who had long said that organized crime either didn't exist or that there was no prosecutable evidence of organized crime. And I think once you have something like that, it's hard to deny that there's organized crime here when you see something like that.
You tell the story from such a personal point of view throughout all of this. I mean, there are parts of this that really just kind of stick in my mind of, you know, you calling to your mom when she's in the kitchen of like, hey, cousin Augie's on TV.
Right.
And just the way that your family reacts in those moments. And
yeah.
The thing that really draws me into those personally told stories are just how vulnerable they are and just being able to really put myself in the reporter's shoes. What about the reporting process and such a personal story was either challenging for you or a surprise for you?
Yeah, it was something I wrestled with for a long time. And I think I first talked about doing this story in 2004 because I was working on a documentary film about border deaths. And I just kind of happened to mention to some of my classmates that my cousin had been murdered by a car bomb. And I thought maybe my next documentary will be the car bombing of Cousin Augie, and I'll be ready to tackle that. But I think for a long time, I don't think I was probably ready to do it back then. I think it's a lot harder emotionally than I really expected it to be. And from my training as a reporter, you know, back in the day, it was suck it up. This isn't about you. This is about the people you're reporting on. You're not part of the story. Don't insert yourself into the story. So I had a lot of walls, I would say, that I put up around myself. And I honestly think it would have been dishonest to readers or listeners to hide that he was my cousin and try to pretend I was just, you know, this uninvolved observer. I think that it would have been bizarre and pretty dishonest to not say, by the way, he was my cousin, and that's why I'm doing this.
I know through our conversations that you also wrestled with, how do you talk about organized crime? How do you talk about Italian-American identity? How did that process play out over time?
Yeah, I think every day, it was kind of a day-by-day sort of thing where one of the obstacles, I would say, is that I am very sensitive to stereotypes that, you know, all Sicilians are in organized crime or all are mobsters or corrupt. And you really don't want to perpetuate these stereotypes, these negative stereotypes about Sicilians. It was something that I was very keenly aware of growing up. I remember my dad was really offended when I think it was like The Sopranos came out of, oh, everybody wants to hear about like Italians and Sicilians being mobsters and killing each other. There was just kind of a big push against perpetuating that. So part of me was, I guess, just really hesitant of, should I even write about this or talk about this? Because here again, it's like we're talking about the mafia again. Also, I think that there was just so much silence with my family and silence around organized crime, silence around Augie's murder, where it truly was something we didn't talk about. And people have asked me that and said, you really didn't talk about this growing up. And I'm like, no, we didn't, except it, unless my dad would say something like, you know, don't gamble, you know what happened to Cousin Augie, or don't talk back to the wrong person, you know what happened to Cousin Augie. And we're always, as kids, thinking, we truly don't know what happened to Cousin Augie because you won't tell us a thing about it. I also think that back in the day, there was a lot more victim blaming of, well, what did he do to deserve it kind of mentality, which is ridiculous because obviously the murderer and the person who placed the bomb are responsible. But I think back then it was kind of a maybe trying to rationalize what had happened by blaming the victim of a crime.
The other part of this whole story that I found really interesting was it allowed me access to a lot of this history that is still so alive within the city and in the bones and the neighborhoods and the places that you kind of take us. I'm thinking of like the Satin Doll.
Yeah.
And all these like places that are still here.
Yeah.
But you also introduce us to Frank Balestrieri. What did you learn that was new about Frank Balestrieri, or did he kind of like line up with what you had imagined and thought of?
I probably could have learned more about Frank Balestrieri. It would have helped if his son, who passed away since I reached out to him, he did not want to participate. I think I would have learned more about Frank from that interview, but I also learned a lot about him just from reading FBI reports and police reports, even with the heavy redactions. There was a lot of interesting stuff and stuff that we didn't get into in really the written piece or even the podcast, although the podcast we were able to get into a lot more that we weren't able to get into in the written piece. But for example, a lot of the police reports, FBI reports, particularly the FBI reports talking about corruption in Milwaukee, were so heavily redacted that it really raised a lot of questions about how much more there is to learn. For example, there was a reference to Frank Balestrieri was very politically connected and he was seen at City Hall talking to blank, blank, and blank.
All the names were redacted?
Yeah, the names were redacted, goodness. Except for his, because he was like the target of the investigation. So you're kind of thinking, well, who was he talking to at City Hall? How high up are we talking? Or he had a connection at the police department and it was widely understood that there were people in the police department on his payroll. and there would be references to he would pay blank to get information about who had applied for a license or blank to get information from police reports. And again, all of the blanks, it's like, curse you, redactions. You're going to haunt me
always
in my dream.
Yeah. Curse the redactions.
Yeah. And then you start thinking, well, what is the statute of limitations for these redactions? Some of these police reports are from the 50s, 60s, 70s. Hmm. And you have to think that some of those redacted names probably are not with us anymore. But it just, there's just a lot of questions that I think my curious reporter brain is still kind of wondering about.
Okay. So there may be a part two is what
I'm hearing. Maybe. Asterisk, done for now. Yeah.
So the print version has been out since for a couple months now. And the podcast has, over the past couple weeks, finally finished its final rollout.
Yes.
But the story isn't finished because the more that you go around and present and talk with folks, as you just did yesterday, people are sharing their stories and their histories. What are you hearing from people and what's the reception been of this story?
I have been very encouraged by how positive of a reception this has gotten. I can't think of the last time that I have gotten nice emails from Republican operatives who I've interviewed, as well as Democratic operatives who I've known over the years who have reached out to write and say how much they appreciated my work, how much they liked it. So also just readers, people who knew Augie or people who knew Frank Balistrieri or members of the community who remembered Commission Row, Broadway in the Third Ward, grew up there, had family. A lot of the people who have reached out to me, and it went from like dozens to, I kind of stopped counting once I got to, I would say like over 200 emails, calls, texts, notes, Facebook notes, which I can't remember the last time a story has had that kind of reception that I've done. But it's also been very encouraging just how many people have come forward with really just powerful, moving, sweet stories about my cousin. And just, I think I was so worried that I would do the story and hear from somebody who's like, well, he killed somebody or he was a terrible person. And it's been really the opposite of people saying, there was a story that's in the podcast about a young man whose father died unexpectedly and Augie surprised his family with a Christmas tree right before the holidays so he wouldn't have a treeless Christmas. People who talked about Augie, if someone got sick, like doing a route, he was in the produce business as well as having a tavern. And if somebody got too sick to do their produce route, he would just do it for them and give them the money and just random acts
dude.
Of kindness
yeah.
and generosity that it made me reflect more of, gosh, in some ways I should be more like Augie in my life and try to be more generous and look out for people more. And I obviously try to do that, but it made me reflect on this person who I kind of grew up thinking was maybe kind of a bad guy or a villain. Mm. And I'm hearing about all of these just wonderful things he did for the community, which is, it's a pleasant surprise.
Mary Spacuzza is an investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez about her podcast, My Cousin Augie. All episodes are available now wherever you like to listen. You can also hear episodes over the next several weeks here on WUWM at 7 p.m. on Sundays. A new season of Bulber Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then learn about the Green Tree Apartments and a photography project centered around the people who've been impacted by the Learning Center there. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recently published a series on the Green Tree Teutonia Apartments, a public housing complex and learning center on Milwaukee's far north side. The series covers the people living and working there, the institution's success stories, and how it defies stereotypes of public housing. Reporter and photographer Angela Peterson spent 15 months at the site gathering interviews, taking photos, and getting to know the residents. She recently gave Lake Effect Sam Woods a tour of the site, where a feeling of safety was palpable.
What does it feel like to feel safe. Of course, there's being physically safe, where your body is not in danger of physical harm. But at Greentree Titonia Apartments, safety comes in many forms. And for Raphael Ford, feeling safe sounds something like this. In the neighborhood. Artist name Mayhem, or Mayhem 3, Ford is a musician, rapper, and a member of the Milwaukee Hitters, a competitive drumline group that you may have seen performing at Brewers games. He spent much of his teenage years at the Greentree Titonia Community Learning Center, catching up on schoolwork and honing his musical talents.
I learned how to do everything in there, pretty much like basic math, and I learned how to read in there because they had me read for extra time. I learned how to make music. But basically, I just learned. I grew up in there. Basically.
The Learning Center and the residents of Greentree Titonia Apartments are the subject of a recent series from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Together, the two public housing complexes house around 700 residents in 328 units. Rent is calculated based on income, with the difference subsidized by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. And units are managed by the Housing Ministries of Wisconsin. Many residents stay for decades and often find work at the complex or by using employment services there. The series was led by photographer and journalist Angela Peterson, who collected stories at Greentree for 15 months. Perhaps by coincidence, or perhaps by fate, her journey to photography was nurtured in the 1970s at a community center similar to Greentree near her childhood home in Washington, D.C. And as fate would have it, her photography journey began with young love.
When I was in junior high school, I had a crush on this guy. I'll just say Dennis C. I won't say his last name.
Protect the innocent. Yeah.
And he was in the photography club. And it was actually this crush that led me to photography. And I don't always start with that story. But my girlfriends, they were like, well, join the club because Dennis is in it. I'm like, okay. So I joined the club.
Her crush didn't last. But a lifelong love for photography was born in this class. Soon, Peterson enrolled in a vocational high school focusing on photojournalism and connected with mentors at the Washington Post to kickstart her career. But even today, she remembers one of her instructors at the community center in Washington, D.C., who gave her a safe space to be herself and explore her art.
The person who led the class, and I don't know his full name, we just called him Bubba. Black man, kind of round, and kind of, you know, almost Santa Claus-ish, like, almost if you will, when he laughed, his stomach kind of jiggled and everything. But he had such a warm personality, and he was so encouraging to me when I became interested in photography.
Walking into Greentree decades later, Peterson remembered getting a similar feeling to the center that nurtured her passions as a teenager, a feeling that people cared and that she would be encouraged to be herself.
I know that Milwaukee in some communities is not very safe, but when I went through the door, I felt safe. And I think the kids there feel safe as well. They feel safe to be themselves. They feel safe to run around. They feel safe to be in a space where they can learn. They feel safe where they could be encouraged. And that's what I took away just within like 2 days of just being there. I mean, just that quick. And I was like, she's like this magnet to not only the kids, but the adults too as well.
The magnet Angela referred to is Vicki Davidson, program director at the Greentree Titonia Learning Center. She's worked at Greentree for 26 years and even lived there for 12. Like Angela and Raphael, she remembers the support she received when she was young, both from her parents and from a friend's observation when she decided to go back to college at Alverno after having her son.
My best friend from high school said, you're going back to school? She said, you should. You're so smart. And no one had ever really said I was so smart. I really had not ever heard anyone say, I didn't think of myself as being smart. And I had to think about that. I said, well, maybe I can do this. Not that my mother and father weren't encouraging. Not that I didn't do okay in school. But for someone to say you're smart, that's huge. And I tell her right now today, you've always been a huge supporter, and it's made a difference. Those words, her words, resonate.
Today at Greentree, Miss Vicki is a never-ending source of love and support. See, many folks come to Greentree at an especially low point in their lives, when stability and safety are top priorities for adults and children alike. The Learning Center offers computers, printers, and services for filling out job applications, writing and printing resumes, and otherwise supporting Greentree residents and the surrounding community in their effort to find a stable income. For children, the Learning Center offers summer enrichment programs, scholastic support, African dance classes, games, events, field trips, and more. The result is a center where children feel safe to ask for help and to create lifelong memories.
When children remember something with joy, they remember a field trip, they remember something Mr. Martinez said or did that they can still laugh about, or they remember something I said or did that they can laugh about, that's where the joy comes in, knowing that you created memories and that the memories mean so much that they still come back to let you know, life is good or that something may not be good. We've had some tragedies over the years, but those are the moments that we live for, I think.
But Miss Vicky will be the first to tell you that often love is rooted in accountability, in seeing the potential in someone and holding them accountable to reaching that potential. To instill this in the young people at the Learning Center, the Greentree staff developed a responsibility paragraph, and children of all ages are expected to recite it every morning during the summer program.
It is time for me to stop blaming others for the way I act and start taking responsibility for my own actions.
I am who I am because of the choices I make.
Responsibility is the key to my success. If it is to be, it is up to me.
Miss Vicky remembers being surprised when her son, now in his 30s, still has the responsibility paragraph memorized.
Years ago, he was in a program, a Saturday program, and he's in his 30s and he still knows it by heart. He says, Ma, he says, I can't believe it. He says, but I do know. I said, you still remember that? He says, yeah, you know, when you learn something as a child, he said, it just sticks with you. And I said, well, then the key to that, of course, is if you can impart and pour into children early and keep pouring into them, it's more likely to stick with them.
Moments like this are what Miss Vicky and the staff at Greentree lay the groundwork for. Miss Vicky will be the first to tell you that progress can be slow, and some folks slip through the cracks, unable to meet the expectations set by the Learning Center or apartment complexes. But overall, public housing communities like the Greentree and Titonia Apartments and the Greentree Learning Center have found a way to get countless Milwaukeeans back on their feet, one job application at a time, one reading lesson at a time, and one calming exhale at a time. And after 26 years of service, Miss Vicky has seen dividends paid on that stability and safety in the forms of stable, successful, and safe alumni.
We've done a lot, and a lot of people have come through our doors. But you know what the most rewarding thing is to have people come back, to have parents come back and tell you, my little kids, remember them? Oh, they're all grown up now, or they're in high school now, or they're in grade school now, and they're doing good. I'm doing good. I just bought a home. I just moved into a 3-bedroom townhouse. And you know what their struggle was when they were here. And then you see from whence they've come and where they are now. That's the most rewarding for me.
And as Angela Peterson can attest, tomorrow's success stories, tomorrow's Angela's, tomorrow's Vicky's, and tomorrow's Raphael's, are finding safety and stability at Greentree as we speak.
There was one student, first name was Angel, and she walked in the first day, and she was very quiet, and she had a book. And she used this book as a shield to not associate with the other children, in my opinion. She's very, very shy. By week 3, the book had come down. She was doing cartwheels outside with the kids during recess. And it creates like this opportunity for kids to forge friendships with each other. Now, don't get me wrong, there's drama that happens too. Some kids don't like each other. That happens everywhere. But I noticed how she started to come out of her shell. And it was wonderful. And the adults, I could hear them talking about that. Look at the, she didn't bring the book today. Where's the book? You know, she's interacting. She's talking. She's, you know, she's putting her arms around someone. You know, she's broken down that shell. She's put it aside so that others could come into her space too as well. And I think that's what happens at Greentree. They create an environment where it's supportive for everyone to be in the same space. They create a space where they want everyone to succeed. Yeah.
That piece was produced by Sam Woods and includes sound from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Angela Peterson, Green Tree Teutonia Community Learning Center Program Director Vicki Davidson, artist Raphael Ford, and Green Tree Youth. The complete series featuring stories, photos, and videos from Green Tree is available at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, X. Gret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Eric Vaughn fellow Nadia Kelly and reporter Lena Tran from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Revy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon to learn what Milwaukee's warmer-than-usual summer could mean for this winter. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Yeah, I had to fight more than often. I was outshined, outnumbered every time. But I made a family run the block, and we too locked in. Walking to the center with my brothers, we is not friends.